We're going to keep talking about a little bit about law. Not a whole lot. I know it seems like we're spending a lot of time in these first two or three chapters, but it's kind of a critical part to appreciating what the rest of the book of Romans has. Do we have, at this point, do we have a clear understanding of what it's like to try and keep law? What does it look like to try and keep law in your life? Say again. You have to do it all perfect. We figured that out, right? We figured that out in Galatians chapter 3, verse 10. It tells us that there's something associated with law. They called it a curse, right? Paul called it a curse that's associated with law. Technically speaking, if you are able to keep law 100% perfect all the time, then technically speaking, you can be good enough to get into heaven. Technically. The problem is, who is capable of doing that? Quinn raises his hand. For the tape. The answer is obvious. It's nobody is capable of doing that. And that's the point that Paul's trying to make here. So what did Ken mention something last week that he said that said the law can't save you. It can only condemn you. What does that mean? Or what do you think Ken meant by saying that? It shows you how imperfect you are. Okay. What else? Say again, I'm sorry.
Through the law comes the knowledge of sin.
Through the law comes the knowledge of sin. Right? So the law can't do anything for you for your salvation. All it will do is tell you, if we went back to the borders again that Ken drew, and if we're operating inside of here, then we're okay. And if we break one of the boundaries, we cross one of the boundaries, law is what tells us what these boundaries are. Whether it's law of Moses, whether it's moral law, whatever law it is that an individual goes by, whatever their conscience tells them, whenever you cross that fence or you transgress the law or you miss the mark, that's how you know what law is. So law helps us understand so we said before, is law good or is law bad? It's good in that it gives us boundaries. Okay, so law can't save you, it can only condemn you. What does that part mean? It can only condemn you.
It can tell you when you crossed it.
And that's all it'll do, right?
You can't keep law, so no matter what you're going
to. It can only punish you.
Right, because you can't keep law perfect.
You can't keep law perfect. It doesn't offer anything other than a set of guidelines that tells you when you cross over, all it will do for you, if you want to phrase it for you, is let you and whoever else know who may be judging you at what point you transgress law. That's all law can do. It can't save you. It can only condemn you. Does that make sense? Like the law, speeding, when it's speeding is 55 miles an hour, anything over 50 miles an hour is a breaking of the law. The law can't help you if you broke 55 miles an hour, right? All it's done is it set a limit, a speed limit, is all the law has done. And all it'll do is it doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't move. What are the flexible properties of law? Zero, right? Law doesn't have, it doesn't have compassion, it doesn't have flexibility. It just offers this, whatever this is. Whatever these fence lines are, that's it. So, what is God going to use to judge someone under law? Right. The question answers itself. It's the law. All he can use is the law. Whatever law that person's under, there's two kind of laws we were talking about before. What are they? Moral law is one of them. What's the other?
Moses.
Law of Moses, right? The law of Moses. Who was under the law of Moses? Not a trick question.
Jews.
The Jews. Who's under moral law? Everybody else, right? We'll read through it again. Well, chapter 2, verse 6 says, "Who, speaking of God, God will render to each person according to his deeds." All right, according to his deeds. And then I'm going to read 12 through 16 of chapter 2. And we've hit on it, and we're going to hit on it again. "For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not the hearers of the law who are just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified. For when Gentiles who do not have the law," talking about the law of Moses, "who do not have the law, do instinctively the things of the law of Moses, these not having the law are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law of Moses, written in their heart, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them on the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus." So we got to read it carefully because, like Ken talked about last week, we have sometimes it'll say the law, sometimes it'll say law, sometimes it'll say the law, and really the article the has just been added in. It doesn't really mean the law. When we think the law in a Bible class setting, we automatically, or at least I automatically, think the law of Moses. But that's not necessarily what they're always talking about. Now, here they are. He's saying when the Gentiles who do not have the law of Moses, when they do the things instinctively that are under the law of Moses, what would some of those things be? Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not steal. Do the Gentiles know that it's wrong to do those things? Are they under the law of Moses? Then how do they know that it's wrong to do those things? Right. Okay. Ken made a point before talking about the Ten Commandments, with one exception, being eternal truths. In other words, it was wrong to kill before the law of Moses, correct? And the example we all know of very well is Cain and Abel, right? So clearly, it was against the law, moral law, to commit murder before Exodus chapter 20 ever came around. Yes, sir?
Question. Those under the moral law, did they have benefit of God's mercy?
The question for the tape is, did those under law have the benefit of God's mercy? And I'm going to leave that to Ken, but I am going to tell you, I think they had the benefit of God's grace. And we'll speak to that in later lessons. I'm not avoiding it, but Ken's going to speak to that in detail. With that exact question. So, that was bad. Anyway, what's God going to do with someone who's never heard the gospel? Judge him, right? We have to judge him, right? We know that it is appointed a man once to die and then judgment. That's it. Okay. So, everybody's going to be judged. Now, how many of you growing up, if you grew up in the church, or in a church, really, you thought, like I did, that somebody was going to get, you know, when they get in front of God, God's going to open the Bible, and he's going to judge that person against the Bible. How many of you thought that growing up? I did. Okay. Did that ever give you heartburn? Did it bother you? Because what's the automatic question that comes up? What about the guy in Central or East Africa, for instance, who never had a chance to hear the gospel? That doesn't seem fair, right? So, what the middle of chapter 2 is telling us, or I would submit that it's telling us, is God is not going to use the Bible or the gospel to judge someone who has never heard it before. He's not going to have to. He's going to take, verse 6 says, he will render to each person according to his deeds. He's going to take whatever law that individual is living under. Now, we talked about last time, everybody has, you can call it a threshold or a thermometer or whatever of morality, right? Do we agree? even murderers on death row, do we agree or they disagree that they have some type of moral code somewhere? Okay, it may be higher or lower. It may be higher or lower within this room. But everybody, every human being on earth has an internal moral code, a moral law. Does anybody have questions or comments about that? Okay. So, in other words, do they know it's wrong to murder? Do they know it's wrong to lie? Do they know it's wrong to disrespect one's parents? Do they know it's wrong to disrespect another human being? They know that, right? They may act like they don't, but they know. We agree? So
to the extent of how bad it is, or where is, you know, how much can you get away with before it is actually bad?
Yeah, how wide? Now, this may vary, right? Is that what we're saying? The boundaries may vary from human to human. But the truth is that the Gentiles who do not have law do instinctively or do by nature the things of the law. These not having the law are thereby a law, a moral law unto themselves. So God's telling us right here, everybody has a moral code that they adhere to. They may adhere to, they may not. And so all God is going to have to do, and this may be stealing some of Ken's thunder, but we spoke about it before, where this whole verse 15 talks about the conscience bearing witness. So let's visit that. In that they show the work of the law written in their heart, okay, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. Now, can somebody paraphrase or tell me what it looks like for a conscience to bear witness? What does that look like? Right. You know, right? You know when you made this jump over the fence. Whether it was you told somebody, like, I don't know, your 2-year-old, not to lie to you, and you turn around and lie to somebody. Or whether you told somebody that, well, I don't believe in that kind of stuff, and then you go home and you set your DVR to watch that kind of stuff. Whatever it is, your conscience is going to bear witness. Now, picture a courtroom. You got a judge. You have a witness stand. You have a prosecution. You have a defense. Does that all make sense? Who's going to take the witness stand at the judgment in this context? Your conscience. So God is not going to open the Bible. The Bible can be sitting wherever. It doesn't make any difference at that point. He's going to say, Eric's conscience. Let me borrow you for a second. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth? Oh, yeah, he can't do anything but that. He's my conscience. He knows when I did stuff right. He knows when I did stuff that was wrong, that was against his better judgment, thereby my better judgment. He's going to say, Eric's conscience, was there ever one time in Eric's life that he did something that went against you? What's the conscience going to say? Yeah, well, not only once. Well, and then I'm going to say, no, time out, time out. Clearly, the conscience is going to say, and that doesn't matter who it is, whether it's Eric in Magnolia, Texas, or whether it's somebody in the Congo, or whether it's somebody somewhere. Yes, Ava.
This is a little unrelated. Well, it goes back to something you said a minute ago. What about Cornelius?
What about Cornelius?
Because he was a devout man who believed in God.
That's right.
There was a need to bring the gospel to him and baptize him with the household.
Precisely. That's exactly right.
Can you explain?
The need for the gospel? Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I understand I'm saying, you know, like, guy off in Central Africa.
Yes, and Ken made this comment last time. He said, and the reason we're spending so much time on these first three chapters is that until you understand how lost a person really is, you won't really understand how important it is to take the gospel to all of creation. Does that make sense? In other words, until you understand and you believe that without the gospel, the world is literally lost. Jesus came to seek and save that which was already lost. So, in other words, the gospel is not what made them get lost. The gospel is the only thing that can save them because they can't live by law.
Right. And Ken's comment last week about, is a person lost because of the gospel, or is it because the gospel exists, or is a person lost regardless of the gospel? And that's what the first three chapters are trying to establish, is that the gospel does not make someone lost. Thereby, the person who never heard the gospel is not lost because they never heard the gospel. The person that is lost, and someone is lost because they broke the law, not because they heard or did not hear the gospel, but strictly because the law was broken, and there has to be judgment and punishment for breaking the law. The gospel is the only way to
get outside of law.
Punishment. Yes.
The goal of the gospel is to not be judged by law.
Right.
So on Cornelius.
I agree with everything that y'all are saying. I guess my question is, what comment? I don't know. You know, the guy in Africa, okay, he's never heard anything. He lost, yes. He never had the gospel, doesn't matter. He's already lost. However, I guess, how can he be saved? Because he's going to be judged by that standard that he was living by, correct?
Yes, let her question sink in. Her question was, how can he be saved if he never hears the gospel?
Because otherwise, why would Jesus have come?
That's right.
So he needs the gospel to
be saved. Yeah, Paul says that if you can be justified by law, Jesus died for nothing, right? If you can be saved by law, Jesus died for nothing. So the answer to your the question that you're asking is making Ken's point.
Later,
probably, but also in that the question is you're helping everybody understand how imperative it is that the gospel be taken to every living creature, because the question that you're asking is a troubling question. How's that guy going to be saved if he never heard the gospel? The answer is he can't. Unless we take him the gospel. Because if taking him the gospel and then he rejects it, this is where I grew up. What if he takes somebody the gospel and then they reject it? Now they're lost. Right, but I didn't understand that when I was growing up, or even 5 years ago. Okay, so we hold up and we say, well, man, don't tell them, because then if they reject it, you know, then they're not gonna be saved. The answer is, they're lost, so we have to take it to them. Which is why we do things like set up the mission in the Congo and things like that. Are we anywhere close to answering your question?
No, you're good.
Okay. She's like, we'll just stop, move on to something else. Ken will be back, if nothing else, to answer that question. Well, the guys in Africa are going to be like, why are they picking on everybody? It's because it's far away. That's the only reason why. If we were in Africa, you could talk about people in the United States. So, we're clear that a conscience testifying looks just like a courtroom for us. The best way we can visualize it is God is the righteous judge. Key point, he be righteous. He cannot be in the presence of sin, right? There are things that God can't do. Kind of a play on it. He can't, what? Lie, cheat, steal, commit adultery, things like that. Things that are under the law, whether moral law or law of Moses. And God cannot bring in the presence of sin. So, the curse we decided was, if you want to live by law and you want to be saved by fulfilling the law, you have to keep all the law all the time. And we know that that's not possible to do for human beings, because we're going to make mistakes. We're going to lie, or we're going to cheat, or we're going to steal, or we're going to offend somebody, we're going to hurt somebody's feelings, we're going to talk about somebody behind their back, whatever it is, it only takes one to keep you from God's presence. Just one. So, we're going to read a little bit. Well, let's ask this question first. Are there Christians trying to be justified by law? Christian, and I'll put Christians in quotation marks. Are there Christians who are trying to be justified by living law? What does that look like? So they get checklists, right? First thing we go to, did you do this? Did you do this? Did you do this? Did you do this? even better. I didn't do this, and I don't do this, and so therefore I am good enough. Now, does heaven, you've heard the descriptions of heaven in Revelation, does heaven sound like a place that God did just good enough? It's good enough. Well, even when he was creating the world, did he say, it's good enough? No, he said, it is good. There is no good enough. Just like you can't be good enough to get into heaven. And to have a hybrid system that Kenneth talked about of, well, I can, you know, do this much good stuff, that'll get me to here, but then I need God's grace to get me the rest of the way up. That's hogwash. That doesn't make any sense. Because you can't do anything to get you the rest of the way. Nothing you can do. You can't keep enough good things. You can't do enough good things. You can't not do enough bad things to get you in. Because how many things does it take to keep you out? One. Just one. Anthony.
I was just going to say, I think one of the things that sometimes to me is whenever you get a traffic ticket, whenever you do something wrong, and you got to go to court for it, you think, well, I need to hire a lawyer who can get me out of the loophole. Find a loophole. I can live within the law and find a loophole. And they don't realize that the judge has the one that gives you the deferred adjudication or comes down and makes you pay the ticket. So they're seeking for the wrong things. And that's kind of the way we do. If we sin in our lives, sometimes we look for the loophole rather than looking for the provider of the grace.
Right. And in reality, what you're asking for when you're asking for a deferred adjudication or something like that, you're more or less throwing yourself on the mercy of the court or the judge, right? In other words, you know what you did was wrong, and you know that you broke the law, but I'm going to ask you to overlook that for me and give me another chance. Which in essence, and we'll speak to this much, much later, but in essence, that's what the gospel does, exactly what the gospel does, is it puts Jesus' sinless life in place of our sinful life. And God can look at us and see Jesus. That's the whole point. So, let's read a little bit. We talked about Christians living under law, and we often beat up, by the way, the Jews for, particularly during the first part of the early church, for trying to hold all on the little bit of Moses' law, right? And can you blame them, really? I mean, we're talking a couple of thousand years of habit that they've been doing these things, that they've been circumcising, that they've been keeping the law, that they've been sacrificing this, they've been doing this on the Sabbath, or not doing this on the Sabbath, and they've been all these things, and now all of a sudden, they're being told by these Christians, by the gospel message, that none of that stuff makes any difference anymore. Now, how would that make you feel if you and your mom and daddy and your grandparents and your great-grandparents have been doing this tradition, keeping this stuff, and somebody comes along and tells you that that's all well and good, but I'm not going to do anything for you? Would it hurt your feelings? What's our automatic first response? We go on the defensive, right? We go on the defensive. Let's read a little bit, starting in verse 17. But if you bear the name Jew and rely upon the law and boast in God and know his will and approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish. In other words, Paul is reading all these credentials of a quintessential Jew. If you know all these things, and you know that you're a guide to the blind, that you're a light to those in darkness, you're a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of the immature, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth. In other words, you are under law, and that law has given you a knowledge of truth. You, therefore, who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that one shouldn't steal, what's it say? Do you steal? You who say that one should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? How did Jesus define adultery? He said, no, I don't commit adultery. I slept with another woman. Have you ever looked upon another woman and lusted after her? Because in your heart, you've already committed adultery. You who say that you should not commit adultery, commit adultery. You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? His final point, you who boast in the law through your breaking the law, what are you doing? Dishonoring God, right? And then verse 24 says, for the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. as it is written in the book of Isaiah. In other words, people who live like you're living, and what kind of lifestyle is he describing here, by the way? It starts with an H. Yeah. All right. If you're living a hypocritical lifestyle, Jew, then you are making a laughingstock of God to the Gentile people, to the people who aren't living under Moses' law. Does that make sense, the point he's making here? If you're trying to live by law and tell other people how to live by law, and you turn around and transgress the law, and by the way, typically the louder you are, I know this one personally, and the more you talk, and the more you talk about the things you should and should not do, seems to be the more people will watch you, right? To see, wow, either he really, really knows what he's talking about, so I'm going to watch him, or this person who's suspicious, who's probably smarter, is going to say, well, let's see if he can practice what he's preaching. Clearly the answer is, you can't, right? You're going to mess up somewhere. So, for indeed circumcision is of value if you practice the law, but if you're a transgressor of the law, Jews, then your circumcision has become what? Uncircumcision. In other words, there's no point. Why? Because if you can't keep all of the law, there's really no point in keeping any of the law if you're living a hypocritical lifestyle. Does that make sense? If you're trying to live by law and your circumcision is of value if you practice the law, but if you're a transgressor of it, then your circumcision is basically uncircumcision. So if the uncircumcised man keeps the requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? In other words, can you recognize somebody that's living under moral law? And in this context, remember, we don't have the gospel yet, as far as this context is talking about. We haven't gotten to chapter 3, verse 21 yet. Paul is setting all this up to prove that nobody can live under law and do it correctly. But he's saying that, let's say you have a Jewish person and you have a Gentile, and you got a Jewish person who is circumcised underneath his trousers, okay, and he is robbing temples, or he is stealing, or he's committed adultery, or he's whatever he's doing, then you have a Gentile living under moral law who is uncircumcised, and he's living a good life, Cornelius, for instance. Okay? Paul's saying, isn't this guy over here, isn't he just as good at uncircumcised as you are breaking the law circumcised? Now, put yourself in a Jewish person's shoes at this point in time, and you're reading this letter from Paul. What was the relationship like? It's getting better. What was the relationship like at this point in time between Jews and Gentiles? Right. Less than cooperative. Right? Pretty good way to say it. That's a docile way to say it. They're not supposed to eat with them. They're not supposed to associate with them. All that kind of stuff. Right? So, for someone like Paul to be telling them, if you're circumcised and breaking the law, you're no better than, in fact, you're less better than the uncircumcised Gentile who's living a decent life, probably didn't set too well with a lot of the Jews. So, and he who is physically uncircumcised, if he keeps the law, will he not judge you through having the letter of the law, a circumcision, or a transgressor of the law? For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that which is of the heart. But the Spirit, not by the letter, and his praise is not from men, but from God. Now, how many people do you know or have you known in the past, whether it's in the church or out of the church, but more drastically in the church sometimes, that are doing things to be seen by men? Right? Man, that's old so-and-so. He's a good dude. He's a real nice guy. He does everything right. Well, you're not watching him, correct? And they don't, you know, so-and-so over here doesn't ever go and doesn't. In other words, sometimes we pick and choose who we think, and this is me personally, I'm talking about, but sometimes we pick and choose who we think is worthy to hear the gospel. Do we not? Maybe I'm the only person that does. But sometimes we have a prejudice looking at someone or talking with someone, whether or not they can handle the gospel. And what we're really thinking is whether or not they can handle doing everything right, aren't we? Like, well, that person can't handle doing everything right. So, I mean, it's clear that they can't handle the gospel. And that is a big, big, big misconception. Because the gospel isn't about doing things right or living by the law. But we haven't gotten there yet. We're still trying to set up the point that people... Now, what kind of Jew was Paul? Anybody know?
Pharisee.
Pharisee, right? He has a resume that he actually reads in Philippians, doesn't he, Marty? Turn to Philippians chapter 3. We're going to start in the second half of verse 4. Philippians chapter 3, we'll start, say, 4b and read through 6. This is Paul speaking about himself. If anyone else has a mind to put confidence in the flesh, I far more. Circumcised the eighth day of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law, a Pharisee, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to righteousness which is in the law, found blameless. So what is Paul as far as a Jew goes?
Super.
He's super Jew, right? Chris Davis. For the tape. In other words, if anybody had a place to about explaining this difference between circumcision and uncircumcision and circumcision of the flesh and circumcision of the spirit, who of the apostles had credibility perhaps to do that? Besides, I mean, we could fairly say probably all of them had authority to do that, but who had probably the most extensive expertise to do that? I would submit it's Saul of Tarsus, the Apostle Paul. Probably had the most extensive experience, studied at the feet of Gamaliel, a Pharisee to the law, Hebrew of Hebrews, tribe of Benjamin. Was he zealous when he was a Jew? That's a pretty good understatement, right? He was willing to travel all over the world at that time, the known world, and capture people he thought were transgressors of the law and blasphemers of God, bring them back to Jerusalem for judgment or stoning or whatever. If you're in Todd's Wednesday night class, he talks about when Saul was on the road to Damascus, to see, that's 135, well, as a crow flies, it's about 135 miles by walking about 150 miles from Jerusalem to Damascus. Now, Todd threw out a stat that it was a six-day walk. And I did the math on that, and that's like 26 miles a day. So I'm thinking not a six-day walk for this kid. It depends on how good a shape you're in. Thanks, Marty. Marty can make it in 6 days. By himself, though. Which he would have a hard time shackling people and bringing them back. But the point we're trying to make is if anybody has a clear understanding of what it's like to be in that paradigm of a Jewish person trying to keep law, surely Paul, the apostle, a.k.a. Saul of Tarsus, has a clear understanding of what it's like to be stuck in that paradigm. What did it take for him to have a paradigm shift, by the way? Yeah, intervention. Literal intervention. They had to stop him on the road to Damascus with a big bright light, and he hit his face and blinded him. Did Paul think what he was doing was right? The Bible tells us that he did. That everything he did was what?
In good conscience.
In good conscience. Right? God knew that. God knew Saul's heart. And he knew that he could use somebody with that kind of zeal in the early church. Just like he knows somebody out there that I don't think can handle the gospel. Or somebody out there that I'm not going to bother talking to because I think it might be uncomfortable or embarrassing for our relationship. God doesn't see it like that. Like I do. Narrow-minded, limited scope. Right? Okay. We talked about moral law, we talked about law of Moses. And so what he's doing here is doing a pretty good job of berating the Jewish people. And we're not going to get into it today, but he's going to spend some more time. You know, you see the very first verse of chapter 3 says, then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the benefit of circumcision? So, but he's going to basically the Jew, if he's like, now I know what you're thinking, Jewish people, you're thinking, well, what was the point of all that? And Paul is going to get into what the point of all that was and what the point of law is, whether it's moral law or whether it's law of Moses. He's going to get into that. There's not really anything new I want to get into. And has the first bell rang? Okay. Questions or comments about anything? Yes?
I'd say if you want to flip.
Oh, time's up. I'm kidding.
You want to flip what you were saying before about thinking about someone who can't handle trying to keep it all good and everything. You can also take that opposite and say, well, oh, I really need to take it to someone who's really bad off, but I'm not going to talk to the person next to me because they seem really good. Even though the person next to you, even though they seem really good,
her point, for the recording, the point she's making is that you could take my argument a while ago about thinking that someone's not good enough to handle it and use the reverse of that and say, well, I'm going to go find the baddest, meanest, ugliest perceived person out there, even though inside Paul said, of sinners I am chief. In other words, I'm the ugliest person on the face of the planet. But she's saying that instead of turning the person next to you who's not necessarily a Christian, but they're doing pretty good. I mean, they're staying, by social definition, they're staying within the boundaries. And it's kind of the point Kim was making last week and a couple weeks before that, which was, you're okay, I'm okay, right? I won't tell you you're doing anything wrong, and you don't tell me I'm doing anything wrong, and we'll get along great, and we'll feel good about ourselves, and what?
Not go to heaven.
Yeah, you'll both not go to heaven. You'll wind up having to face your needs, right? Because we all have an alternative. There's two alternatives. You can either be judged by law, or you can be in Christ. That's the options. But not yet in Romans. We're not there yet. Okay? And I promise we're going to answer the question about Cornelius, because I can remember from the study we did, he talks about Cornelius specifically. I don't know if it's this quarter or next quarter, but we are going to talk about it. What else? All right. Who's got the prayer? Let me stop this.